At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Thank you so much for joining me. It was lovely that you reached out on Instagram. I think that it's always so nice when people message you to like say, oh, you know, I really want to speak or whatever. And particularly, I guess, this week. Is it this week? Is it Awareness Week or is it an Awareness Day? I think it's day,
Tuesday,
isn't it?
So it's a day, yeah, mental health.
Yeah. So Mental Health Day. And it's really interesting, actually. Like I've seen a lot of people this year focusing on like rather than awareness, like this is not an awareness day, it should be an action day. And mm-hmm. I think it's quite interesting how like it's almost, I think, a real positive rather than being like, oh, we need to take action rather than just being aware. It shows how far we've come, because before we weren't even aware that people were struggling with their mental health.
Yeah, exactly. I think we are getting to a point now where things are going to change, but it's just happening very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the title of this, I can't remember what it's called, but you know, like the focus of this Mental Health Awareness Day is mm-hmm. It's a universal right or a human right.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. But I like to just talk about everything. I think it's, you know, despite what the topic is this year,
mm-hmm.
I think it's really important that we do talk about everything alongside that.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why I'm so very grateful that you're here to chat to me today. And obviously we do normally focus on eating disorders in this podcast, yeah. But I think we'd be very naive if we kind of sat here and thought, oh, you know, eating disorders occur exclusively. Nobody ever has any comorbidities or anything like that. So I mean, that's why this is going to be such an interesting conversation, to think about the comorbidities and how that impacts people and sort of like, I know I mentioned to you like the chicken and the egg situation. But I guess to get started, do you want to give like maybe a bit of an introduction to yourself and how things like mental health and other aspects have impacted your life?
Yeah, so basically I feel like I started having eating disorder symptoms at the age of maybe 11, and that kind of happened for 10 years. I really struggled with social interactions as a child and fitting in and everything. I was like such a high achiever. I was always getting really good grades up until about year 9, you know, and then you kind of hit the burnout stage and then everything comes tumbling down after that. But so I got diagnosed eating disorder about the age of 15, anxiety, you know, got low mood, and a depression when you're young. But then when I got to uni, my eating disorder spiraled out of control, because obviously you do get lost between services, you fall through the net. So I did get hospitalised at that point. So I've had about 3 years leave of absence. So I'm in my final year now, but I've actually, this is my sixth year at uni. So I started in 2018. So it's been a journey, but I finally have my autism diagnosis and ADHD diagnosis. But before that, I got sectioned for just like general mental health after uni. And they said that I had a personality disorder. So I think everyone's very aware about the, well, maybe they're not, but the overlap of symptoms of ADHD, autism, and personality disorders. And then I think eating disorders just can creep in with any diagnosis. And I think we all know how common it is with autism, especially. I know some hospitals are actually doing like an autism screening when they get admitted to an eating disorder ward, which I think is really amazing, and making adjustments despite if they've got a diagnosis or not. And I just think that's like a real step forward. But yeah, that's kind of a brief overview. So I've been out of hospital about a year and 3 months. I was at a long-term placement, so I was on a PD ward for a year. But now I'm back at uni, finished my second year last year, which was an achievement. I've never done a whole year without being sent home. So that was a big achievement. And now I'm my final year. So, and then obviously working for the NHS as well, which is a real turnaround. It's really funny actually, because the other day I did a shift on the ward that I was first sectioned on as a support worker, and it was just like, oh my goodness, what a real turn of events, like being sat here as a professional now. It's just madness. But yeah, real breakthrough, I guess, with the autism and ADHD diagnosis.
Yeah, I think you should be so proud of yourself. Like, that is amazing to have gotten through a year of university, and shows how far you've come. So absolutely, like, hats off to you. I have a lot of questions from what you've just said. I guess the one I want to come to you first, because I feel like it maybe might not be the shortest answer, but you were saying about the fact that hospitals are now doing autism screenings. When you go into hospital, my only thought there is that a lot of the time, specifically if we think about anorexia, like, because of the severity of these and sort of the low energy, things like that, things do become very rigid, and the symptoms that people show quite often mirror that of autism, but somebody's not actually autistic, it's just because they are in calorie restriction and stuff.
Completely agree.
How do they navigate that sort of thing?
I think it's more for reasonable adjustments than a diagnosis.
Okay.
So it's more, what adjustments can we put in place to make things a little bit easier, rather than going for the full-blown diagnosis? And I think a lot of people that do enter hospital have been through services. So it could be that those that, you know, show very clear signs are the ones that go through for the full diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think my thing would just be...
I'm not 100% sure about it. Like, I'm not 100%, I've just heard through the grapevine that this is something that's being put in place.
I think it's a really difficult one, and I don't want to kind of, you know, just say, oh, everyone that has anorexia that shows signs of autism, it's just because they're energy deprived. Like, I know that's not the case. It's just, it's interesting with the whole reasonable adjustments thing, because I know that, so I follow, I don't know whether you follow her on Instagram, but Live Label Free talks a lot about autism and eating disorders, and how recovery does actually need to look so different, you know, like having food at a specific time of the day. That needs to happen because for her, she would just forget otherwise. But for me, somebody recovering from an eating disorder is actually really important, you know, at
you
a certain
that
point.
Variability.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, you put in the reasonable adjustments, but how can you know that that's not just holding someone back from recovery?
No, completely. I think reasonable adjustments can look so different for different people. And I think especially with ARFID, that is quite common with autism especially. But yeah, I'm not too sure how it's going to look, but I think like the professionals would probably have some idea of who mm-hmm. needs what, yeah. you know. So someone like yourself that needs that kind of variability compared to someone who is going to, it's going to ruin the whole week because something's out of whack, like out like 2 minutes late, you know. I think
yeah.
That could be the case for someone with an eating disorder. It might ruin their whole week because something's a little bit different. But it's when it's consistently, even when with weight gain, it's still distressing if yeah. something's a little, you know.
And I suppose
I think it's really hard to weigh up.
Maybe looking at the bigger picture of wellness, for somebody that isn't autistic, it's probably just fixated around like food and exercise and that sort of thing. Whereas somebody that has autism, it might kind of span over different areas of their life. I don't
yeah exactly
know.
And it's looking back to childhood as
yes.
well, and you know
yeah.
how it's developed
sure.
through time, you know.
Yeah,
so someone with an eating disorder might not have had that at, through childhood.
Yeah,
but then,
that's a really good point.
Yeah,
yeah. And then I wanted to, because you said people are quite aware, but actually I am not aware at all of kind of the overlap between autism, personality disorder and ADHD. So I wondered if you could share
yeah.
a bit on that for us. That'd be great.
Yeah, so there's a really interesting like Venn diagram of how they all overlap. So I think it's by Misdiagnosis Monday. So it's like impulsivity is obviously very common with personality disorders and ADHD. Oh, you put me on the spot here.
Sorry.
but
maybe
I think
you can say from your perspective.
Emotion dysregulation, like that's very common with ADHD and autism. You know how someone's very emotionally dysregulated, people may just think that that's a personality disorder because they're happy one minute, sad the next, but it could be autism and ADHD. I know for me, it's like relationships as well. Obviously, social situations are really difficult. And yeah, I've actually been pulled up for my facial expressions when I was in hospital, saying that it makes me unapproachable. But my facial expressions don't actually match what's going on in my head a lot of the time.
Oh, wow.
So that can make it really difficult within relationships. They may get the wrong idea.
Yeah.
But I think it was really inappropriate for them to call me out on that. And that just made me really distressed because obviously I want to be approachable. This is the job
yeah.
I want to go into in the future. It was the day I came off my section as well, but you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry, this was like you were a patient and you were
yeah.
called out on your facial expressions. Who called you out?
A clinical psychologist.
Wow.
I know.
With like what aim?
She just said it makes me unapproachable. And said that, like, she was basically just telling me to think about what my face is telling people. And she had the autism diagnosis, like, they had the autism
wow.
diagnosis, you know, that what you get, like, the big feedback thing. And at the end, it says, body language, don't take body language as it is.
Wow.
And so, yeah, it's good that they took time to read that, I guess.
Yeah. I guess, you know, if you're going to try and support somebody and say, you know, like sometimes your facial expression maybe doesn't match how you're feeling and like we can work on that by, then that I think is a good way to approach it. But to just say to someone like, work on your facial expression, that would surely
yeah.
make you feel really insecure. I like
exactly.
doubt what my face is doing all the time.
Exactly. And it's like, I could look really miserable, but like I'm happy in my head. It's just that they don't link. And that's really common with autism. I think it's common in a lot of people, but to call me out on like one of the happiest days was
yeah
really uncalled for. But I love telling that story.
And when you say personality disorder, just for people listening, if they've not heard of that before, like what does that mean?
Interesting question, because it can mean a lot of different things to different people. So the ICD-11's actually changed, which is basically it has a bunch of codes for people that don't know, and it basically all the diagnoses. So it's now just personality disorder, and then it's mild, moderate and severe. Before it was obviously emotionally unstable, antisocial. I think there's a list of like six or seven, but
okay.
Now it's just personality disorder. But basically it's someone that's had like an invalidating past, a maybe traumatic history, have a lot of trauma, the people can't understand how to regulate their emotions. They don't know how to ask for help. They don't know how to, it's really difficult. It's not that they don't know how to communicate. Well, yeah, they don't know how to communicate their needs, basically. And so there's a lot of self-harm, suicidal ideation. You might have eating disorder within it. There's a whole list of things. Like, it's different for every single person. So in the DSM-5, there's like over 200 ways to meet a diagnosis of emotionally unstable personality disorder, I think. So yeah, it's very different for different people. But I think I probably did show signs of a personality disorder due to growing up until I was 21 or 22, undiagnosed, neurodivergent in a neurotypical world. Like, how invalidating is that? Like, at school, you're not getting your needs met, all of that. Because I didn't have a traumatic childhood. In fact, it was quite the opposite. So that's why I always question my diagnosis. But now I don't think I would actually meet a diagnosis of a personality disorder. And that is actually like a common thing that could happen, but obviously people can relapse. So it's hard to take away that diagnosis. So I think it's changed to like personality disorder traits now, alongside autism and ADHD and previous eating disorder. But yeah, it's really difficult to say what it is.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Because it just looks so different.
Absolutely. And so were you sectioned for the personality disorder, or was that for the eating disorder?
So I went on a planned admission for my eating disorder, and then I don't even know how many times I've been admitted for my personality disorder. That was, all the sections were for my personality disorder. I got diagnosed actually after the 28 days of the section 2 with a personality disorder, because in CAMHS they kind of say like emerging personality disorder, because you can't really diagnose it until someone is mature enough that, you know, they've got through puberty and all of that. So it's really difficult. I believe they shouldn't really diagnose until after 25, because it's actually been shown that's when somebody's personality is developed. But it's usually diagnosed a lot earlier.
So I'm sorry, I'm just trying to piece my head around this. So you were misdiagnosed with something and then sectioned. So do you think that this section was appropriate, or do you think that that was based on a misdiagnosis?
I don't know whether it was a misdiagnosis. Like, I do think about it a lot, because, like I say, the invalidation of growing up undiagnosed neurodivergent, that is enough to develop like unhealthy coping mechanisms. Right. But at the time, I probably did need to be sectioned, just because for my safety, basically. And then obviously the long-term placement was for therapy. So I received dialectical behavioral therapy, which is it's a approved, I can't remember what the word is, but it's like an approved therapy for personality disorders. Okay. And it was my third go at that, because I have never been able to complete it before.
Okay. Wow. Okay. And did you have the eating disorder before that, or after, or was it during?
All three.
Okay. So I had 11.
Yeah, so I had, that was like the first sign that something wasn't right. I was in eating disorder services for years, as an adolescent and as an adult. I only got discharged, I think, in 2020 or 2021. Which actually wasn't too long ago in the grand scheme of things. So it was just before I got sectioned. In fact, I was actually with them whilst I was on my first section. Then I got discharged because I was doing that therapy in the community, and it was like a conflict. But when I was on the ward, I did like exhibit eating sort of behaviours. But obviously you still get thoughts now, like, don't get me wrong, I don't think it will ever go away. but I'm much better at managing it. I think it mostly comes from the autism. So when there's change or when I'm distressed, that's when I'll fall back into, you know, eating soda sorts and habits, but I don't really engage in like restriction or anything anymore.
And when you were sectioned for the personality disorder, was there any support for an eating disorder, or was it kind of just very focused on the thing that you've been sectioned for is personality disorder, therefore that's what we're going to support you with?
Exactly. So on the acute wards I was on, they basically just prescribed Fortisip or Ensure, which, and there wasn't much support unless there was some of the staff that got it on shift. So it was really difficult at that time on the acute wards, because no one really, they're not trained for eating disorders. It's quite a specialty. But when I got to my PD ward, one of my medications wasn't put in my blister pack. So I went like a week and a bit, and it just sent me off the rails because I didn't have this medication. So I fell back into eating sort of habits, but they said, because I think I struggled for like a week, but then they'd like told me if I didn't eat if I skipped a meal, then my BIP would drop, which is behavioral incentive program, I think. So basically every week your incident free goes up one, and then the privileges increase with the amount of incident weeks free. So yeah, they said if I didn't eat, then my BIP would drop, but there was no support in helping me to eat. It was all PD. So yeah, that was quite difficult. And I didn't want my BIP to drop because I'm autistic and I need it to keep going up.
Well, I think even if you weren't autistic, you know, if you're in a hospital, you know, for a mental health, even if you're just in hospital, at the end of the day, you want some luxuries, you want some privileges. And so to just threaten somebody with, if you don't eat, we're going to take that away from you, like, that is not a long-term way to help support someone recover from an eating disorder.
It's so true, because I had home leave every weekend, so that would go, if, like, that's what my worry was, that it would go, or you'll lose your leave, like local leave. So yeah, I really did not want it to drop. I mean, my BIP was getting very high because I only engaged in problem behaviours for 2 weeks, like self-harm. So, and I was there for a year, so it did get quite high.
And so I'm really interested, just because I've genuinely not spoken to somebody before that has been sectioned under the Mental Health Act, so I hope you don't mind me asking questions.
But that's fine.
Like, what happens in like the day-to-day routine there? Like, you were there for a year, so that's a long time to be somewhere, I would imagine.
So being supported. The hospital I went to was actually 2.5 hours away from home as well, which made it really, really difficult, because obviously I could only see my family at weekends, whereas on my acute ward it was around the corner, so my parents could come all the time. So yeah, it was really difficult. There wasn't really much to do. Obviously we had a lot of groups, so I think there was like 3 groups a week because it was a therapy ward, and then 2 like little mini groups a day, just like to set the goals for the day and then go through whether you'd achieve them. But other than that, it was kind of go on leave if you have it, which not many people did. And it was always a case of just going shopping. And I'd probably go to Primark twice a day. Just because there's nothing really else to do. But then on the weekends, I did go home. But yeah, it was like you had to be up by 9, like, that's when the first group was. And then obviously we had protected meal times for lunch and dinner, so you had to be on the ward for them. Other than that, there was not really much else. We kind of tried to keep each other occupied. But then on my acute wards, there is really nothing to do. There's no groups. OT would come, do some things, but I'm not really a crafty person, so that's all that was really on offer. So basically I had to stay in bed a lot, like a lot when I was on the acute wards. It was, but then I didn't have any motivation to do anything. And also on one of the times I was sectioned, I actually had COVID the whole admission, so I couldn't even leave my room.
Wow.
So yeah,
It just doesn't sound the most, like you said, you know, you didn't have motivation to do anything. But I think we can all admit that, like, when we're in an environment that's not a stimulating environment, it's very easy to quickly get stuck in a rut of, like, I don't want to get dressed today, I don't want to shower today, like, I don't have anything to do, therefore I'm just kind of going to sit around, that sort of thing. And that's all the kind of stuff that when we're struggling with our mental health that we're told not to do. We're, like, really encouraged to go out, get some fresh air, like, see friends, do whatever, you know. It seems really strange that they wouldn't kind of have those activities for you to do.
Yeah, I think it's just because there's, like, quite a staff shortage. And on one of my acutes, there wasn't a garden. You had to have leave to go down to the courtyard because it was upstairs, so that made it really difficult. But on my local acute ward, they did have a garden, so you could go outside if the weather was nice and play games and stuff. But it's all dependent on risk, whether you can leave the ward, and my risk was quite high on the ward. But I think that's just because I was so, like, frustrated and, like you say, just stuck in a rut. So that made it really difficult. And yeah, they were quite short admissions though on the acute wards, but because they were so regular, that's why I had to, like, I didn't have to be sent out of area, but that's why it was decided that it might be best, like, just get this. It was supposed to be 15 months, but I discharged myself early because I was frustrated. But yeah, so that's why it was best to go to the therapy ward. And luckily for me, it was like the kick up the arse I needed. You know, I can't do this again, like, I need to get back to uni. But for a lot of girls, because it was a female ward, you know, if they don't have goals, it's really difficult to have that motivation to get out. And I think when you're on a ward, everything's done for you. They tell you what you're doing, when. That's why I found it really hard to come back to uni after my 2-year leave of absence, because I had to do everything for myself again. I had to, you know, set myself a routine, whereas on the ward everything was just done for me, and everyone told me what to do, when, which actually worked really well for me because I like being told what to do, like, and, you know, being put that routine in place for me, which isn't a lazy thing. It's just, okay, someone's telling me I need to do this, so this must be right, I'm gonna follow that. Whereas I can be really uncertain. I'm like, is this the right thing to do? Like, you know, it's really difficult. So I think you just get so used to people doing stuff for you that it's really hard to get out the system.
Yeah, and I can imagine after 12 months or whatever, you know, you've very much, that's become your home. Like, that is a long enough period of time for that to be your safe place. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about how you did then, because I'm sure a lot of people will have had that of sort of coming out of hospital and then being like, okay, kind of get how I'm meant to do it, like, recovery in there. And I thought that was a really interesting thing what you said there about, like, when someone tells you what to do, that's okay, you just go and do it. I'm very much like that in my recovery at the moment. If, like, somebody serves me a meal and they're like, that's what you're eating, I'm like, okay, well, I've got, like, you know, you've told me to do that, and you love me and you want to protect me, so, you know, that's okay. But I can't currently do that for myself and actually give myself something that's sufficient, because it's like, that's then coming from internal. So how did you navigate sort of coming out of the hospital to then, you know, being like, okay, now I have to make the decisions, and especially being away at uni as well, because I can imagine you're not at home with family members?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. I absolutely hated being on that ward, like 2.5 hours away from home, so it wasn't as difficult coming out of there, and I didn't have any, you know, bonds with staff. And so that made it a little bit easier, because I absolutely hated it, hence why I discharged myself. I just got so frustrated that they were really invalidating, saying I wasn't doing enough in the community when I really was. I couldn't do much more. I don't know what they wanted me to do, to be honest. I needed to leave that environment. And so that made it so much easier to come home. I was so much more relaxed. I needed to be with my family and friends. Whereas coming out of the acute ward, I found that more difficult because I had good bonds with the staff. And obviously, you know, that's hard to leave behind. But, like, now I don't get that. Like, I don't feel like I need bonds with other people to feel satisfied in myself. Like, I'm quite happy being alone now. like I love spending time by myself more than anything. Like I really love it. Whereas before I constantly needed reassurance, I constantly needed like validation. I don't anymore. I can do that for myself, which I think makes it really easier. And I don't know how that happened. I feel like after my diagnosis of autism and ADHD, I felt like that was validating enough. And I felt like that was an explanation for me to the way that I was, and that I'm not just like bad behaved or, you know, risky for, I don't know, it just all kind of made sense and it was validating. So, and also I think medication, the ADHD medication has really, really helped me like motivation wise. So I can now set my own routine, and I can, you know, and also because I drive now, I had like a bit of a time off driving, but because I feel like I've got my independence back, like I drive from uni back home all the time, you drive around to work, you know, I have that freedom again, which I find really, really helpful. And I could see an improvement in myself since driving again and the ADHD meds, and it just all kind of like clicked into place. And I think with all the adjustments at uni as well, like I have really good support at uni, and I think that has made, I think it's just made it like they really want to see me get through, and I'm so grateful. Like I literally couldn't ask for anything more from uni, and I think that is really rare. But to have me for 6 years, that's quite, you know, it's quite something. And she like my mental health advisor supported me the whole way through it, and I honestly owe her so much, because I really would not have got through uni without her. She helps me set routines. She helps me, well, she just helps me with everything, liaise with everyone, you know, and she just lets me rant to her. It's just, yeah, it's just what I needed. But I think obviously coming out of hospital, it is really difficult, but I did have that like transition period. So I think I came out at the end of April, and I didn't come back to uni until October.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
So I had that kind of settling down period at home first, before I had this independence again.
Yeah. It's really interesting what you say, like things started to slot into place. Because I think one thing I've been finding recently is like the more that you see about the sort of freedom that you can have away from, you know, in my case, an eating disorder, but you start to, like things start to unravel a bit and you're like, oh, like I was actually way more connected in that conversation, or like had so much more energy. Like it's just a really silly thing, but I have been staring at, I went on holiday, when did I get back? I got back a few weeks ago. The suitcases have been in my on my landing for however long since I got back. I keep looking at them, I'm like, I just don't feel like I've got the strength to put them in the loft. And today I was like, I think I've got the strength. And then I was like, wow, this is because I've actually been looking after myself and fueling myself properly. And I think then when you start to see things that you're missing out on, and that you can then do, and you know, it sounds really silly, but like the independence of me being able to put the suitcase away rather than relying on somebody else is really, really nice. And I think that's kind of what you were saying in terms of, you know, you started driving and then you could notice the independence and you start to feel like you're getting yourself back. And I think it's brilliant as well that your uni have been so supportive. And I'm just wondering, I know you mentioned a few things, but if you had any tips for, you know, if somebody's listening and maybe they work at university or with students or whatever, like what would be your main advice for supporting somebody that has had difficulties with their mental health and is sort of in a similar position to you?
I really just think validating someone. And because I think a lot of people can be dismissed, like you've made it to uni, you're fine, like if you're at uni then that you can't suffer with mental health, you know. So I think it's just validating that whatever someone's going through is so real to them, and so, you know, it's really affecting them, and just validating that and being empathetic, sitting in their shoes, you know, and just listening. That is literally all my mental health advisor does, is she just listens. She doesn't try and solve any problems unless there is something that needs solving, but she doesn't I don't know, it's just that connection, and it's more, she understands, I feel like she understands me better than I understand myself. Like everything she says back to me, it's just like, oh yeah, you know. But I think that kind of is probably because I've known her for 5 years. So she's seen me at my worst, and now she's seen me here. And one thing I really hate is when someone says, you've been through this before, you can get through it again. Because I feel like that's quite invalidating, because at that time, it doesn't feel like you're going to get through it. I would more say, like, I'm here to sit through you with this really bad time. You know, it's more, you know, just validating that time and just listening to whatever that's going on there and then. I do just think listening is like the biggest help, because some people just don't want answers, they just want to get it out and to feel listened.
I think honestly that is a lot of the time, like, and I think that's that's a really interesting thing that you say, because I think a lot of the time when people think about mental health, if they know that like a family friend or somebody is struggling with their mental health, they're like, oh my god, I don't want to bring it up in conversation because what if I say the wrong thing? And ultimately, like, I don't think that you, unless you say something like, oh, get over yourself, like, you know, that sort of thing. Yes, that's probably not going to be the best thing to say. Sometimes, not maybe get over yourself, but I think sometimes people do need a kick up the arse to kind of move them on and sort of get feeling better. Anyway, that was a tangent. I think often when we are struggling, we do just need somebody to listen and somebody to care, and validation, I think, is a really key word that you said there. You know, I know when I speak to my friends, I'm not expecting them to know the answer. I'm not expecting my therapist to have the answer. I just want somebody to, you know, be able to sit there, be able to listen, make me feel cared for, make me feel loved. And then, you know, sometimes I suppose with a therapist, it might be that they help you to think about things from a different perspective than what you have done before. But I think in terms of friends, like, you know, just being there for somebody is enough.
Exactly. I completely agree. I was going to say something then, but ADHD brain's gone. Oh, gosh.
Don't worry. It's fine. I wanted to ask you, we kind of touched on it a little bit. You said about your misdiagnosis and stuff. One, I have like a couple of questions around it, but I'll go for this first. How did that make you feel when you, well, I suppose you were saying earlier that you did think that you had personality disorder, so it's maybe not a misdiagnosis, but it was maybe that they'd missed the diagnosis of autism and ADHD. Like, how did that make you feel when you realised, or when they then came with the diagnosis?
I think it just like reiterated the invalidation. It's like, how could nobody have picked this up when it was so clear? Because my parents had like thought about autism throughout my life. It runs quite thick in our family. Right. And they mentioned it when I was under the priory, and the priory were like, no, we need to sort of eating disorder out first. And it's kind of like, if you'd have acknowledged the autism, maybe like that would have helped with the treatment of the eating disorder. So it felt like a weight had been lifted when I was diagnosed, but I hadn't really thought about whether I actually had a personality disorder. I thought I had all three until maybe a year or so later, and I was like, yeah, but the overlap of symptoms, maybe it is just autism and ADHD. But then the more I think about it, I'm like, is it not? But in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter. It, as long as I get the right treatment and I have obviously got to where I am, I don't care what the diagnosis is, as long as I'm on the right path to being well and having the right support and adjustments, then call it what you want. Honestly, you know, I really don't mind. Obviously, having a diagnosis for personality disorder with the stigma attached to it can be quite difficult, but I'm lucky enough to have not faced that much stigma, touch wood, because people don't need to know that I've got a personality disorder. Obviously, I'm literally broadcasting it on here, but I don't mind. If you want to think that I am XYZ, then you think that, but I know the truth, and I know what I've been through. I know where I've got to, and I know all the hard work I put in between. So it's kind of one of them things. I think it's so difficult. There's obviously not a brain scan to diagnose any of these things. So it makes it difficult.
That's what makes it so hard, isn't it? is the whole one, like everyone's experience is different. And you said earlier, like there's like 250 different ways that you can diagnose personality disorder, which is pretty vast. Like that's quite a lot. And I find it really interesting. I've like done a few podcasts where I've brought this up before in terms of like, rather than diagnosing a specific eating disorder, like we could say eating disorder full stop, and then you support somebody with their specific symptoms. You know, you have like Hannah's profile, and then you support Hannah with the individual things on her list, because just because I have anorexia and then the person next to me, like our symptoms could be completely different. And it's almost, I'm almost questioning whether, like, how helpful a mental health diagnosis is. I think for some people, it can be helpful because it can be a validating experience of, like, you know, we've recognized X, Y, and Z in you, and we think we have this. But I think also there's a lot of potential of it going wrong in terms of a misdiagnosis, people getting a certain type of treatment that actually isn't supportive for them, but you know, you think it is because the NICE guidelines say that that's the right treatment for somebody. And then also with the stigma attached to it, I think that can then be really difficult because you can stigmatize yourself. Other people can stigmatize you as well. And it was almost like you were saying, like the crossover with so many different symptoms, like, you know, there's the Venn diagram of personality disorder, autism and ADHD. But, you know, for me, when my anorexia gets bad, my anxiety gets horrific, and so does my mood. I'm so low because I do not have the energy to be happy, and I take antidepressants for that depression. But I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to invalidate anybody's experience here, but it is very much like how much of it is, for me personally, is driven by the eating disorder, because I know that once I start eating a bit more, I'm, you know, less anxious about, I'm still anxious about food, but I'm less anxious about life and I'm happier and stuff. So how much of them then impact each other is crazy to think about as well.
Exactly. And that's where I think my eating disorder came from. I think it was just from the invalidating school. School was the most invalidating environment. I think it was just like all of that, obviously neurotypical world, not for me. I think that has led to me to just use like an eating disorder as like a coping mechanism, a way of control, because the world was so out of control. So I think that stems from the autism. And then obviously being autistic has obviously led to the PD because of how invalidating the world is. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of how linked are they? It's kind of like we should have a list of symptoms, and it's kind of like, right, these all interlink. Which one do we try and target first? But I know some services are actually moving away from diagnosis, so you don't need a diagnosis to access them, which is a massive step forward. But then obviously having a diagnosis opens up doors for some people. It's just really hard, because once you get that diagnosis, it's really hard to remove it, and it's kind of like, we call it the sticky label, because you know it's really hard to get rid of. But yeah, it can be quite damaging. And this is what I was going to say, this might be controversial, but sometimes if someone is showing signs of an eating disorder, but maybe it stems from, you know, anxiety or something, but anyway, they get diagnosed with eating disorder. I know for me, like as soon as I got diagnosed, I was like, right, I need to conform to this diagnosis. You know, I need to like live up to the name.
Yeah.
Which, looking back, that I can hold my hands up and say that. But I think that could be the case for a few people, that once you get a diagnosis, you conform to that diagnosis. I mean, look at that study. Who was it? Oh, my brain's not working today. Zimbardo, where he put like prison guards and then prisoners into a prison setting, like as a study, you know which one I mean. And it's like how they conformed it, and it turned so dangerous and unethical. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, I feel like that could be the case for some diagnosis. Like people feel like they need to conform to it.
Yeah, like based on the expectations
of professionals around you,
To
stay in treatment, maybe.
It's really good point, to stay in treatment, because it's that you need that diagnosis in order to kind of open that door for you. I don't, you know, from my personal experience, obviously this is very much anecdotal, I haven't had that with anxiety, of like feeling anxious enough, but definitely with depression and with anorexia, you know, not feeling sick enough. You know, I'm not sad enough to have depression, or you know, I'm not kind of thin enough to have anorexia. And I think but then it's really difficult because I know when I was diagnosed with depression, I was like, like, this isn't how everybody lives. Like, people don't feel this intense sadness like all the time, or like not even the intense sadness, but you know, that constant like dread or like worry about something. Like, that's actually not how a healthy mind works. So that was kind of validating, but it's then where you draw the line of like which mental health conditions are okay to diagnose, which aren't.
Yeah.
But I do like the idea of having like a list of symptoms and supporting somebody with that symptom, because I think that fundamentally is a more long-term approach. And I recorded a podcast this week, which will actually be out after this podcast, with Richard from the Eating Disorder Recovery Clinic. And he said that their approach there is very much a stepped approach, in terms of they will like target one thing, like the psychology-based thing, and then they'll work on a bit of the foody stuff, and then they'll work on another thing. And I think that stepped approach allows you to, rather than trying to tackle everything at once,
yeah,
it's specific to you, so your individual behaviours, but it also like gives you time to actually settle into it, and rather than just like, okay, here is the thing that you've relied on for all these years to get by, and now you've not got that anymore.
So then you turn to other coping mechanisms, which are even, you know, could be deathly. Well, eating sort of deathly, but you know, it could turn quickly. Yeah, I completely agree. It's really difficult. I think diagnoses are important, but at the same time, if you can access a service, if there are services that are accessible without one, I think that is just invaluable. And like, I do agree with the stepped approach, but at the same time, we need like looking at the whole picture, like every single problem, you know. Instead, you know, if you've got like anxiety, depression, eating disorder, autism, it's like all of them need to be looked at once, and then where is it coming from, which can be really difficult because they just happen so quick. But yeah, it's a really difficult one.
Is it not really overwhelming as well to have all of those diagnoses?
I mean, I don't have them all anymore, which is great, but like I say, I don't really, it doesn't bother me, like the diagnosis side of things, as long as I had access to the treatment that I needed. Then it was, but like I say, I do think I conform to the eating disorder diagnosis, because I do think it was due to like autism and change. That's why I used eating disorder as like a coping mechanism. But then I felt like I had to live up to the diagnosis of anorexia nervosa. So it's a sticky situation, I guess. But I'm glad that it's no longer you know, a conflicting issue for me.
And did you find that as you like began to learn more about your autistic traits and your ADHD traits, and sort of, you know, put in place things to allow you to utilize them rather than them like getting in the way of life, did that improve your eating disorder?
To be honest, I don't really know at what point my eating disorder improved. I do think it might have been medication, because some medication can cause weight gain, and I feel like that kind of cured the malnourishment, so I could kind of think straight, and food wasn't an issue because my body was just so hungry from the medication. But I think understanding, I think the year away at the placement definitely gave me a year to think about myself and learn my limits and learn what triggers me, and you know, where what behaviors come from where. So I feel like that was useful. I did that myself. It wasn't the hospital. I don't want to give them credit for that, because that was me.
Good on you.
I don't really want to give them credit for that. Yeah, I feel like that was a good year to think about myself. It's like kind of like when people go to a retreat, you know, like a yoga retreat. But I think it really did help, because I learned a lot about myself, especially being away from home and having to do a lot for myself. I had to do my own washing, because when I was on my acute ward, I just sent my washing home with my mum. So, and like, cooking meals myself, because I did start self-catering and then self-medicating. So I think, yeah, it was beneficial to learn more about my autism, even though it was dismissed at that hospital. But I knew, at least I knew, and I could work on it.
Yeah, I think, like you said, just that validation of, oh, it makes sense as to why I have, you know, why I do these things in a certain way, or why this makes me feel more comfortable. It absolutely makes sense that, like, once you've got that, which is why, you know, diagnosis can be so helpful. Even ones, you know, because I do think that, like, things with, you know, like neurodiversity and stuff are very, they're different to mental health conditions, because mental health conditions are something that you're, you know, hopefully going to recover from, whereas neurodiversity is something that, you know, you are learning, well, you learn coping mechanisms to support you. You're not going to recover from it. But yeah, thank you so much, India. I don't know where that time has gone. We were going to talk about social media as well.
We had so much to talk about.
We'll have to do another episode, because it will get too long. But thank you so much.
It's been lovely speaking to you.
I'm really grateful for you sharing kind of your experience, and, you know, I'm sure that will absolutely help a lot of people. Where can people go to find out more about you and the work that you're doing?
So I'm on TikTok at India Blakemore, same for Instagram, same for Twitter. I post more worky things on Twitter. Don't have many followers. Oh, sorry, it's called X now, if you didn't know. But yeah, I post a lot of all of what's going on over there. Haven't had much time for social media though recently. It's all been a bit
doesn't girl. Sound like it with all your jobs and uni and all that.
I know, London tomorrow, but
spreading yourself thin. Well, thank you so much. Go and have a nice restful evening.
Oh, it's been lovely, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, India. If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.